And we will call to order the Energy Environmental Resource Committee for Thursday, May 13th, 2021. Let's start with our roll call. And I believe Trisha's on deck as well for this meeting, which we appreciate.
Thank you, Chair Evans. Blythe?
Here.
Cathedral City?
Present.
Coachella? Desert Hot Springs?
Desert Hot Springs is present.
Indian Wells?
Present.
Indio? La Quinta?
Present. Mayor, I'm sorry, I'm reading my emails.
Palm Desert?
Here.
Palm Springs?
Present.
Rancho Mirage?
Here.
Riverside County District 4?
Here.
Coachella Valley Water District? Imperial Irrigation District? Mission Springs Water District?
Here.
Agua Caliente Band of Cahuilla Indians? And Riverside County District 5?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. We have a quorum.
Great, thank you so much. Just a reminder, we are still virtual, as you can see, based on the state of emergency and the pandemic, but we do have ability to submit written comments and or call in or raise hand comments on these meetings. And at this time, we'll move to public comments on agenda items. Now, I know we've got, I believe we've got Chuck Parker who requested to speak, and I will call upon him during his request for the goals and objectives discussion. But Trisha, do we have anybody else that would like to make public comments at this time?
I do not see any hands raised at this time, and Chuck was the only person who emailed, but Neftali Galarza just came in as an.
Okay, note for the record, we've got actually Neftali Galarza for City of Coachella, and looks like Chairman Jeff Gruby from the Agua Caliente tribe has also logged in. Thank you for joining us. Well, then let's get right into our committee member director comments. Katie, do you want to start us off with any announcements?
Yeah, I have nothing for you today. I will say, and this will come up when we get to goals and objectives, I apologize. I have arranged for Patrick O'Dowd from the Salton Sea Authority to speak to the committee in June. He wasn't able to make it today, but he will be providing an update at the next meeting. So that's all I have, thanks.
Okay, and then director or commission member, committee member comments? Forget what commission I'm on. Seeing none, let's move into our consent calendar. We just have the April 8th committee meeting minutes, a spirited meeting at that. Any questions, comments, or revisions on those? If not, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes on the consent calendar.
Make a motion to accept.
So I'll take a motion from Rancho Mirage, Charlie Townsend, and a second, would you say, was that from Donna Griffith?
Indian West?
Perfect. All right, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor, please say aye with your fingers. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Seeing none, motion passes unanimously. It looks like we also have Emmanuel Martinez from IID that has logged in. Thank you very much. And we'll move on. And then we've got a guest speaker, which is fine. Let's go on to the discussion action items. Items number 6A, which is electrifying the Coachella Valley incentives and rebates for EVs. And Katie, go ahead and introduce Shant, our guest speaker, and Emmanuel. Okay.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this morning we have a presentation from both Southern California Edison and Imperial Irrigation District on some of the programs that they have available for electric vehicles. Certainly we're anticipating with a lot of more push towards cleaner fuel vehicles that we'll be seeing more funding opportunities for those vehicles. And that will be a good opportunity for cities to take advantage of some of those. And we've asked them to share with you some of those, that information. So starting out, I wanted to introduce Shant. And Shant, I'm going to ask you to maybe pronounce your last name, if you would, for me.
Sure.
Shant from Southern California Edison. And Shant is going to give you an update. And then we'll move on to IED. So thanks, Shant, very much for being here. We appreciate it. And go right ahead.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, all. My name is Shant Nahapetian. Oh, you can just call me Shant. It's much better than my long last name. But thank you for the opportunity to present to you all today about our Charge Ready program. I hope to keep this fairly concise and open it up as much time as possible for questions. So let me just jump right in and begin by saying that at Southern California Edison, we're leading the transformation of how energy is produced to help the state meet its ambitious greenhouse gas reduction and air quality goals. We're halfway on our pathway to delivering 100% clean power to our customers, and we're working to plug more cars, trucks, buses, and equipment into that clean power supply. So to that end, you know, we're working to support mass market adoption of electric vehicles. And to achieve that, we need to make it easier, as you all know, to make it easier for folks to charge their cars at homes, apartment complexes, workplaces, and public places. So we're deploying new charging stations across Southern California through various programs, including our latest Charge Ready program. Our new Charge Ready program will launch this summer, targeting July, with the goal of supporting the installation of roughly 38,000 charging ports across our service area over 5 years. The program will have an extraordinary focus on equity by locating half of those charging ports in communities that are most heavily impacted by the combined impacts of economic, environmental, and public health burdens. And those are otherwise known as the State Designated Disadvantaged Communities, or DACs. Charge Ready will also help expand the promise of electric vehicles to more people by really focusing on supporting charging station installations at multifamily dwellings like apartments and condo complexes, which are harder to electrify. And a key theme of the program, which you'll hear me repeat as I go through, is a focus on addressing those unique challenges faced by customers in disadvantaged communities and those in multifamily properties. So at a high level, through Charge Ready, SCE installs and maintains the supporting EV charging infrastructure, that's the Make Ready infrastructure. And then we provide rebates to reducing charging station costs while the participants typically own, operate, and maintain the charging stations themselves. Through the program, we can also provide technical assistance for siting charging equipment, access to our experts, and resources to help each project move forward. Next slide, please. Thank you. One more slide. Thank you so much. So at a high level, Charge Ready has three primary offerings with a few secondary options to help customers choose which option might work best for them. We have aggressive program targets to ensure that the ports and the participants are spread out equally among our service territory. And the first option, which you'll see here on the left is the charging infrastructure and rebate offering, which is the largest component of the program with a target of installing the infrastructure to support some 20,000 charging ports at non-residential and multifamily sites like destination centers, workplaces, and apartments. This offering has a few secondary options, which I'll show in just a moment and speak to them one by one if time allows. But the one thing I wanted to call out here again is the fact that 50% of those ports would need to be in disadvantaged communities, and 30 of those ports will need to be sited at multifamily dwellings. And the charging infrastructure and rebate option will also eventually include a small DC fast charging component of about 200 ports. We're awaiting additional CPUC guidance on the DCFC component. So we expect that to be available later this year after we actually launch the program. The second offering is our turnkey installation right there in the middle, which is designed to address the financial and technical barriers to EV adoption at multi-unit dwellings in disadvantaged communities specifically. And as the name suggests, it's really a full turnkey solution. We can essentially cover everything. We can install the infrastructure on the utility side and on the customer side. We can purchase the charging stations and operate them as well. The only thing the customer would be responsible for is the electricity cost, But that can be recouped on the charging station through usage fees if the customer so desires to do that. And it's important to note, even though this is a turnkey solution, the customer would still retain control of the pricing and policies of the charging station, even though, you know, we're offering it as a full turnkey. And then finally, we have the third offering there, which is the new construction rebate option for multifamily new construction properties. And this offering recognizes, you know, is really based on the premise that the most economic time to install charging infrastructure is at the time of construction, but most EV capable building standards today don't actually require the installation of the charging stations themselves. As you all might know, the CalGreen building codes mandate a certain percentage of the parking spots in multifamily new construction be EV capable only. So we're trying to incentivize developers to go beyond the building code requirements, and we'll offer a rebate per charging port to newly constructed family properties to ensure that the building actually has operational EV charging upon completion. And to put a finer point on that, because this question does come up, by newly constructed, we mean applicants must have a certificate of occupancy for that multifamily development that is granted after January 1st, 2017, or they have yet to be granted a certificate of occupancy. So it's not technically new build as in 2021 and beyond. Next slide, please. Thank you. And that, to kind of help present a clearer picture, I included this diagram to demonstrate what we're talking about on a simplified project site and to better explain the different program offerings. You can see the various infrastructure components in this more straightforward example of a project site. Now this is really the value proposition. Normally, we're just responsible for the left side, the utility side, but through Charge Ready, we can take care of almost everything you see depicted here. This applies to the infrastructure upgrades like the higher voltage electric panels, the conduit, the wiring, all to facilitate EV charging station installations. And then the table below breaks down the offerings that just described with a little bit more detail about the additional options under our charging infrastructure and rebate offering. For the sake of time, I won't go into each one, but I do wanna note that later this year, we hope to provide a fourth option under our charging infrastructure and rebate offering for site hosts who may want to install four or less charging ports. So it's kind of a low port option. And in that case, we'd be able to provide maybe upwards of a $5,000 rebate per port to help offset charging station installation costs for again, non-residential and multifamily properties. Next slide, please. Thank you. And then here's just an overview of the program guidelines and requirements. I'll just highlight a few of the more important ones. The applicants must be non-residential SE customers. They need to own, lease, manage, or be the customer of record of the charging site or obtain consent if they're not. Of course, the applicant must be must grant SE an easement for us to actually do this work and install the charging stations and the supporting infrastructure. We have an approved list of products who've met certain requirements, so customers can choose their charging station solution from that list, and it's an exhaustive list. So there shouldn't be any issues there in terms of identifying the products that the customers would like to use. And then we ask that customers ensure that the operation of the charging infrastructure for at least 10 years to protect the public investment that goes into those. And then a separate meter is required for almost all of the offerings except the new construction offering, because we have stringent reporting requirements to the CPUC. And while we're on this slide, let me just maybe with the time I have left to talk about EV rebates. In addition to making the significant investments in expanding the EV charging infrastructure, we also offer rebates to help more customers transition to EVs. One example of that would be the newly launched California Clean Fuel Reward Program, which provides customers, or consumers, I should say, a $1,500 reward at the point of sale for the purchase or lease of a new plug-in electric vehicle. It's not a rebate that you have to apply for. It's you know, the point of that program really is to help reduce the cost of the point of sale. And we hope that will simplify that transaction and make it more easier for customers to adopt EVs. And this program is available to all Californians, regardless of utility territory. And then the second rebate I would like to just call to your attention is our newly launched pre-owned EV rebate to offer customers even more savings. So through our new pre-owned EV rebate, SCE residential customers who purchase or lease a pre-owned EV can qualify for a $1,000 rebate on vehicles purchased or leased after January 1st of this year. And I would just conclude now by saying, and as you can tell, I've went through it very quickly, but we've carefully designed these offerings to make them more workable for our customers and try to serve their unique needs. We're currently in the final stages of refining the program for launch this summer, as I said, targeting July. And we expect the program application period to remain open until 2025, assuming the program funding isn't depleted before then. And then construction at potential future project sites is expected to proceed concurrently and into the future. So if you'd like more information about the program or are interested in applying when it launches, you may let my colleague Jennifer Cusack know. You can let your SCE account managers know, and I'll certainly include my contact information in a chat window as well. We're happy to connect you to the appropriate folks at SCE to help you answer any questions you might have and enroll in the program. And with that, I'll just conclude my remarks and open up to any questions you might have. Thank you.
Sean, thank you very much. We do have a question by Russell Betts mm-hmm. with Hot Springs. Russ.
Yeah, thank you. On the charging times, if you go mm-hmm. up to the Tesla location up there at Cabazon, mm-hmm. you got drivers there spending up to two hours charging and a waiting line. Mm-hmm. And you had level one charging, which as I read is 120 volts, which basically would take longer than a night to charge a vehicle. Mm-hmm. Level two, which would be 220 volts. And that would be a little quicker, but even beyond that, they're talking about rapid charging that will mm-hmm. Maybe charge a car in 30 to 45 minutes, getting it to 85% capacity. You mentioned introduction of level one and level two. Are you introducing level one into like a service station type environment, or is that only for homes?
Yes. So that's a very good question. The program itself is not meant for residential customers, but we are targeting, of course, dwellings in that we're targeting multifamily dwellings, apartment complexes, and condo complexes. And in that regard, we leave it to the property owner to make the determination of which charging option is most suitable for them and their residents, level one or level two.
Is this only for homes?
I'm sorry?
You're talking about only for homes when you say property owner? What property are you talking about?
It could be a home, or it could be a commercial site, like a commercial site where you have multiple vendors, like a commercial site, like a retail site, a lot, something of that nature. The level one and level two charging stations are part of the program. We leave it up to the property owner to decide which charging option they want to install in their particular sites. Your question, I think, about the Tesla chargers goes to the DC fast charging component of the program. There will be a small DC fast charging component. DC fast charging is not cost prohibitive, but it's exponentially more expensive than the infrastructure it requires to have a level one or a level two. DC fast charging can, I believe, charge a vehicle up to 80% in some cases in 30 minutes. There will be a small component of that, but we're going to be targeting short-term dwell locations where we expect users of that charging station to be around for maybe an hour to two to do that. And because of the high cost of those DC fast charging sites will only be available for commercial or public properties that are widely accessible to the public. So I don't know if I answered your question properly, but I guess the short of it is that we really defer to what the property owner, whether that is an owner of a multifamily dwelling or a commercial facility or a government facility or some other public location, to make the best determination of whether level one or level two will work for them. my inclination is that they will make the investment in level two charging because it's the happy medium.
What's the charge time on a level two station? Is it all day?
No, so it depends on the vehicle and depends on that particular site. But for instance, a level two charger could charge a vehicle up to 50, 60 battery miles in maybe 5 hours or something or less.
Okay, so just to wrap up my question here, I think in your presentation, as you make this, that I think the charging time is so intrinsic to acceptance by the public of electric vehicles. That and Tesla is going with the fast chargers that are still 30 to 45 minutes, 5% compared to gasoline, which is 5%. And we're going to be asking the public to make the switch. And I think you've got to include in your presentation the charge times. And level one to me seems wholly impractical to offer that as an option. And I'm no expert, I only read, what I'm reading online and stuff on the subject, but I really think you need to make sure in your presentations that the charging times are included, because level one, level two sounds like a solution, but in my mind, it really isn't. That's all I have. Thank you.
That's point noted.
Thank you. And let's go with Dennis Woods from Palm Springs and then Nancy from Cathedral City.
Thank you, Mayor. A couple of questions. The first one is a very high level question, just because we deal with a regional basis, how this body deals regionally. You know, SCE and other power providers have done a lot to kind of try to save energy. You know, we've done home weatherization and we've given incentives for all kinds of reducing the power. What is the power grid if we're going to go to all electric? I mean, is it there, or are we going to have to start importing more dirty power from other states?
So the power grid is cleaner now and will continue to be clean. I think that question gets to the whether or not the grid will be ready to support this increase in electricity demand and over time. And our answer is yes. A critical aspect of our planning process is ensuring that the grid is ready and capable to meet customer demands. And when we work with project sites, whether it's electrifying some light duty charging installations like what we're talking through about this program, or some of our more medium and heavy duty charging facilities, we're able to work with the site host to ensure that there is adequate power supply on a micro level, that the grid can actually support their electricity needs in the short term, and that we are working to factor in that greater demand on the grid long term. So in a short answer, at the moment, we're delivering about 50% of our power through clean resources. We need to be at 100% by 2045, and we believe we'll be able to get there. But that's the big picture. On the small picture, we are able to support installation of electric vehicle charging, and our grid planning team works very closely with the site host to ensure that their needs are being met in the short term, and when we can continue to provide electricity to support EV charging into the long term.
And then the second question I have is, you said that there's an incentive SCE is going to come up with to give a rebate on pre-owned electric vehicles.
Yeah.
And they had to be an SCE customer. So, Palm Springs is in Desert Community Energy, but SCE delivers. Do they still qualify for that kind of a rebate?
I believe so. I will confirm that, but I believe so.
Great. I would appreciate that.
Yeah. I'll make a note.
I'll put my email in the chat. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Nancy, and then Charlie.
Yeah, thanks for the presentation. It was helpful. And I just have a point on your incentivizing. I am personally out shopping for an EV, so I'm all over rebates and tax incentives. And I just want to remind you and the people listening that the clean fuel refund or reward is only for dealers that have signed up to participate in that. So you can't just drop into a dealer and expect you're going to get that. They have to be a participant in that program. Thank you.
Thank you. That is a very good point, and thank you for pointing that. I should have noted that. I am optimistic. Talking with my team today, they've confirmed that we're at 85 to 90% of retailers statewide, and they are very confident that we'll have near full saturation, certainly by the end of this year, but your point is well taken.
Thank you.
If I might just say, the Clean Fuel Reward website, which I believe is cleanfuelreward.org or .com, previously did have a list of participating retailers, and I believe they still do, to help consumers find which retailers in their communities might work best for them.
You're right, they do.
Great. Charlie, and then Supervisor Hewitt.
Thank you, Linda. You know, in the old days in gas stations, you could fill up with water, you could fill up with air with no charge, and that has all changed. So maybe I'm missing something here, but today you go in and you pull into a parking lot at CVAG parking lot, you plug in and there's no charge. My point is, how are we going to be charging, or how are these companies or these commercial entities sooner or later are not going to continue giving this away for nothing? Have we looked at what is going to be charged, and is each company or each location have a, you know, drop in the quarter thing, and they're going to charge what they want to charge? Sean, help me.
Well, that's a really good question. And the answer is that there are a number of private companies who are in this sphere now, and they're developing novel business solutions around what you just proposed in terms of how do you have ubiquitous charging, and how do you do it in such a way where a tenant or a property owner isn't just providing free charging, but maybe if I'm a commercial property owner, my day job is to run my property, not help folks fuel their electric vehicles. But companies like EVgo, ChargePoint, and other electric vehicle charging station providers have today, and I believe will continue to provide, sort of turnkey solutions onto themselves, where you pay them maybe a monthly fee. They take care of the infrastructure and the customer billing, and they will charge the customer. They will recoup their investments by charging the customer maybe a markup on the energy that is used. So your point is well taken. I think that solution is being sort of addressed by the marketplace. So it'll be interesting to see how it evolves to the point where we do have ubiquitous charging, and it does feel like a gas station where you can go to any gas station, charge easily by swiping your credit card or paying it cash. That is something that the marketplace will have to work itself out. That there are companies who have found novel solutions to that. For instance, if I were to go to a grocery store in my neighborhood, it's not Albertsons who's necessarily operating the charging station, but they've contracted with a company like EVgo or ChargePoint, where ChargePoint collects the money necessary to recoup the customer's electricity expense and then make a small profit as well for managing that charging station.
Very good, Chan. Thank you. And let me ask you this, in your crystal ball, down the road, as we continue on with getting more and more electric vehicles on the road, and I'm going to take a trip from a Rancho Mirage to San Francisco along the way, I don't have time to plug in for 4 or 5 hours, you know where I'm going. Yeah. Do you see this ever coming down where it would be, you know, put it in like you're getting gas and then 30 seconds it's done in the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know enough about the battery technology to say we'll get there where it takes just 30 seconds or so and you're in and out. But I think the real promise is the DC fast charging that I mentioned earlier, which can potentially charge your car up to 80% in 30 minutes or so. That is the technology we're dealing with now. It is admittedly a lot to ask of people in some cases, because you have to modify your behavior to make that work in your life if you're taking a trip. But your question is a good one. I don't know the answer, but I hope we can get there. I think where we are now with DC fast charging and the Tesla superchargers are a prime example of this is, you know, people just factor that additional charging time into their destinations or their journey, and they'll spend the 30 minutes that they're using charging their cars to grab a bite to eat or shop or what have you.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And hopefully the Jetson foot mode will kick in here where we can just fly in and do it for 30 seconds and on our way. I'm sure it's down the road somewhere. I don't think in my lifetime, but thank you. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Let's keep going. Supervisor Hewitt.
Yeah, this is a very, very great discussion. I have to actually agree somewhat with Mr. Betts there that just think if we were going to put in a system right now for internet and we're going to use dial-up. Remember how long that was? You know, I don't know why we're putting in any level one or level two. When it takes overnight or something, some commuters and everything, that works fine. They get home. They leave their EV, you know, plugged overnight and everything. But I'm telling you that it's those fast chargers, those ones that do take a half hour to 45 minutes. And the people in their Teslas watch a short movie while they're doing that, or go to McDonald's out there, by, you know. But let me tell you some other things. Like, again, I brought this up the other day in our board meeting. You know, we're also going to be forced to go to all electric heavy-duty trucks, especially with the new AQMD rules that are laid out with logistics and stuff. Consider all this, regardless of whether we're getting clean or dirty energy from Utah, Colorado, or whatever else. When we have all of our, or a good portion of our transportation based upon electrons, and all of those electrons are coming out of plug-in places that are a part of a huge grid, think what happens when we have rolling blackouts or a really big blackout. You're going to see people shut down, you know, on the freeways everywhere else too. So going forward, we have to have all kinds of safety net things and everything else, because our quest for going clean may leave us high and dry into the future. So these are all things. We can't wait for a train to go by for 15 minutes. If we have to wait for more than about 30 minutes to recharge an EV, this is money I don't think that's well spent if we don't do it so that the customers will actually use it.
Thank you. Question for, I see Gina's got her literal hand up. Gina?
Yes, I just want to share the sentiments of Supervisor Hewitt and Councilmember Betts and Townsend, and you've already taken my questions for the most part. I just don't see this being practical. While I appreciate SCE's efforts to donate, I think it's 30,000 charging ports, but wouldn't it be money better spent to use the technology we have, like the Tesla fast charging, and focus whatever resources you have to at least make the charging stations 30 minutes? I will say we have a Tesla and we're going to sell it because we work full time and we can't sit and wait for, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours to charge our car again. So we are going to be selling our Tesla because the infrastructure just isn't there. So I just think SCE's money might be better spent trying to get as many fast charging as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for the feedback. A question, I see Emmanuel Martinez is on this presentation as a co-presenter. Do you have a separate deck that staff will be sharing, Emmanuel?
Yeah, I have a PowerPoint presentation ready
okay.
for you.
All right. Let's go to that because I know we also have... got two other pressing topics, which we're glad for the exchange, but I want to make sure we give time to those as well. Let's go ahead and
proceed. All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Honorable Chair Evans and members of the committee. I'm Manuel Martinez, Government Affairs, Imperial Irrigation District. So I'll be brief and provide you a presentation on EV rebates that the IED has put in place for those communities that are east of Washington Street. So cities of India, Coachella, La Quinta, and the unincorporated areas of Riverside County. IED is committed to making sure that California is on a path to adopting electric vehicles as required by the state. And we have adopted a recharge EV rebate program to help our customers transition to clean transportation as well. So next slide, please. I mentioned the recharge program that IED has put in place. It's been around for about 3 years now. And allows electric customers in the IED service territory to qualify for up to $500 for charging stations at their homes. The chargers must be level two, 240 volts. I know there's already a lot of conversation about that. I know the charging time varies on the type of vehicle you have in place, but for instance, Just a comparison, you can fully charge a vehicle in 3 hours with the level two as compared to 20 hours with the level one. And that's just a very rough estimate, just to give you an idea. Another type of charger that qualifies is Tesla's high power wall charger. Obviously right now everything's Tesla, and they have their own charging equipment as well. So those type of chargers or UL equivalent listed charger would qualify for our rebate program as well. Next slide, please. The rebates are intended for EV vehicles that we are going to use in our transportation on our freeways, highways. So you cannot get a charger for your golf cart. And we put this because I know in some areas here in the Coachella Valley, these are very popular. So you can't qualify for a neighborhood car or motorcycle or electric scooter, other low speed vehicles. Just want to make that clear. Next slide, please. Rebates are only for existing homes. So anything that is built in 2021 is currently not eligible to qualify for this rebate. However, the unit responsible for this program is currently also looking at expanding this program. I know there's talks about CARB's clean fleet vehicle for medium and heavy duty trucks, and a lot of our governments are going to have to be transitioning their medium and heavy fleet to adhere to the CARB's requirements. And so we're also looking at potentially expanding those programs to also incentivize our governments to qualify for this program. But for the time being, rebates are only for existing homes that are within the IID customer territory. And so for this fiscal year, you have to install that piece of equipment this year to qualify. And if you do have a charger that has a greater charging capacity, then we will consider that on a case-by-case basis. And just to be clear, in order to ensure that we optimize the resources available, you can qualify up to $500 or 50% of the purchase price plus installation cost. The majority of the folks who are applying for this rebate do get a professional contractor to install this charging station. So typically, you know, we've seen those installation costs run from $450 to about $800. So plus the actual piece of equipment that puts you a little bit over $1,000. So most of the people applying for this program will qualify for the $500. But if you wish to install that yourself, then we cap that at 50%. Next slide, please. So how to apply, just go to our website, iid.com. We have a customer service tab there available where you can pull up our Evolve platform. And the Evolve platform provides really great tools having to do with EV chargers, cars, map where local charging stations are, and just tools that help you evaluate whether EV is cost effective for you. So again, go to our website, purchase and install this year, and submit the application within 90 days or before the end of the year to qualify for the rebate. With that, that's my brief conversation. I will say regarding the clean electricity and some of those questions, I just want to elaborate a little bit further and say that all public utilities and or utilities in the state of California have to adhere to the RPS. The next big stepping goal there is 60% by 2030 and then 100% by 2045. So just thought I'd throw that in there. And at this point, I'll be happy to answer any questions or take any comments you may have.
Thank you, Emmanuel. Any questions for Emmanuel regarding IID? How many people have applied so far? I know we're only into May.
I don't have the exact number, but I do know that after checking with our unit who's administering this program is that we have sufficient funds available. We have budgeted $100,000 for this program. And in previous years, there's been money that has been left in those in that pocket of dollars for this program. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're in the third year and we've always had sufficient resources to cover the applications that have been coming in.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? I don't see any hands raised, but you're welcome to unmute and ask them.
So I said I would be brief.
You did. I appreciate that. Supervisor Perez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Emmanuel Martinez, appreciate it. And just a quick question. If someone wanted to install the infrastructure at that home, at their home, what would be the cost for that? Do you happen to have that number?
Yeah, the cost. Mm-hmm.
And just one other question is, I'm assuming maybe on the website, right, for IID, there's probably a map of all the stations that exist.
Correct. So the so to answer your first question, the cost that we've seen in coming in for reimbursements for this rebate is about $450 up to $800. Okay. So of course, do your research. Again, the low end is $450 for installation cost. And we do have, as mentioned, an Evolve platform that encompasses everything electric vehicles. It's basically a tool, database that we have available where you can get access to this application to get the rebates. We have a map that will show you all the electric vehicle charging stations here in the Coachella Valley or throughout the state. So it's a really amazing tool. So if you're going to travel, you can plan that out accordingly. And then it also has listed federal and state incentives as well that you may qualify. So you are able to calculate whether, you know, the electric vehicle you want to purchase plus the incentives would be cost effective for you. So as part of that Evolve tool, you can also see all the number of electric vehicles that are in the market as well to help you calculate the cost of what a vehicle would be for you.
That's good. So now I didn't realize that existed. Okay, thank you, Lynn.
Thank you. And Tricia, just want to know for the record, I know Oscar was on the participant list. He's now on the video list, but he's been on for some time, represented from City of Indio. So just want to make sure he's duly noted. And Alex Cardenas has joined us from IID as well. Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I see Supervisor Hewitt. Go ahead.
Yeah, real quick, Emmanuel, a little bit more on those. You're coming off on your... on your deal, you're coming off the main panel right there. You're not setting up a separate panel with another meter like Edison was doing several years ago, where they got a different rate for charging an EV, right? This is just coming off that, putting that one receptacle there. You're pulling the 220 off of a 200 amp main panel, basically, right?
That is correct, Supervisor Hewitt. Completely correct.
Yeah, so that cost will stay within under $1,000. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, okay. All right, this is an information only topic and obviously of good discussion and more to follow. And Shant and Emmanuel, thank you both for providing information on your respective areas and the resources to follow up if we have additional information or questions.
Thank you.
Let's move on to item 6B, which is the IID CVWD and the 1934 Agreement of Compromise for Providing Electric Service in the Coachella Valley. And I'll allow Tom Kirk to do the introductions of our two guest speakers.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I get a message from your chair about every 3 months that says something like 10 years isn't far off. It's almost 2032. Tom, let's not let this fall through the cracks. Right, Chair? And what she's referring to is the IID CVWD agreement. Of course, La Quinta, nor the cities, nor CVAG are a party to that agreement. And you've heard a little bit in past meetings about the nature of the agreement and its expiration and steps being taken to address its expiration. We get to hear the latest from IID. We've got, of course, your colleague on the committee, Alex Cardenas, and he's brought with him IID General Counsel Frank Oswalt. And we've combined, even though it's not exactly the subject matter, Assemblyman Chad Mays. And as you know, Assemblyman Chad Mays has been concerned about representation on the IID board with respect to the Coachella Valley. And we have John Noble, who will give us an update on the Assemblyman's efforts. And I gather the Assemblyman, this go around, has been in close coordination, in fact, with IID on the Assemblyman's efforts. So we look forward to hearing an update on both. And Chair Evans, we will not let this fall through the cracks. This is one of the more important issues for the entire Coachella Valley, East and West, and we can be on top of this one. With that, yes. Director Cardenas.
Yeah, and just real briefly, Madam Chair, and I just want to also say I sincerely appreciate the efforts and the talent that's in the energy and environmental resources. And so my approach would be that we would be proactive in our communications. And again, I'm very respectful of everybody's time, but also talent. So I'm going to really get on the front end of this and make sure that IID is taking a leadership role in sharing information, giving a holistic view on kind of some of the things that we're facing, and then working with Assemblyman Mays and the discussions and as this bill moves through. So it's just an informational item, but I do want to show the leadership as a representative of IID that I am available and welcome any questions, and our staff is able to present, provide color, provide any information you guys like regarding this. We love this community, want to continue to serve in this community, and we're definitely ready to take on some of those discussions or any inquiries. So that's the whole premise behind having this item, Madam Chair. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to our counsel, and then he's available for Q&A. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Oswald.
Oh, thank you for volunteering me, Director Cardenas. Appreciate that. I gave a presentation similar to this about a month ago to the Energy Consumer Advisory Committee, and I believe Mr. John Pena, a city council person from the city of La Quinta, was president, and it was done at his request. And I took a little bit different tack in presenting this because I thought it was important for people to understand that there is a historical context to where we are today. And history really does mean something because it really gives flavor, it gives color, it gives character, it gives understanding to what people are, the positions that people are taking on issues as they come up. It's hard to consider and talk about AB 1021, for example, in a vacuum without understanding how we all got here today. So with your indulgence, I'm going to go back in time a little bit. And I know we say this is about power and it's not about water, but that is just simply not true as far as the Imperial Irrigation District is concerned. This is about water to a great extent. And I'll attempt to explain to you why so that you understand it. It goes all the way back to the 1890s when there was no water in Imperial Valley. It was a desert, arid, nobody could live there. But the CDC, the California Development Company, filed a notice of appropriation on the Colorado River intending to divert up to 10,000 cubic feet of water per second from the river and use it to irrigate farming and ag in both the Imperial and Mexicali valleys. They attempted to do this, but it really was, history will show that it was just beyond their capabilities. And then tragedy struck about in 1905 when the Colorado broke a heading and began to flow all of its flow into the Salton Basin or the Salton Sink. Prior to that time, the Colorado drained into the Sea of Cortez. That took 2 years of intensive work. And I think it financially broke the California Development Company because ultimately Southern Pacific Railroad became involved in the ownership of the CDC. But about in 1911, the Imperial Irrigation District was formed. And up to that time, the California Development Company had provided water to the Imperial Valley through the Alamo Canal. And this was not the All-American Canal that we know of today or the Coachella Valley Canal. This was a meandering canal that ran into Mexico and back up into the United States and provided water to those who were then attempting to farm in Imperial Valley. It was obviously seen by those who were attempting to develop the pioneers in Imperial Valley that this was just not an adequate solution. And people voted to form the Imperial Irrigation District in 1911 under the irrigation law of the state of California. In the meantime, there were private developers who were selling energy and electricity into both Coachella and Imperial. W.F. Holt created a power company, the Holton Power Company in 1903 and began serving some ag users and others in the Imperial Valley. I think Coachella Valley was served by another company at that time, but it developed in concert with the farming and development of the ag community in Coachella Valley. By 1916, Holt had sold his company to the Coachella Valley Ice and Electric Company, who provided the continuing of power to the Imperial Valley area. Now, Coachella Valley Ice and Electric Company was providing energy to the Coachella Valley at this time, back in 1916. They began to provide it to the Imperial Valley. And almost immediately, people became, from what I understood from reading the histories, unhappy because the cost of electricity had to transport it all the way down to Northern California. They had the usual line loss and the inefficiencies, and it was very expensive to get the electricity. So people immediately started thinking about, well, how can we explore the possibilities of hydroelectric development on the river or canal system to develop a cheaper source of power that can serve at least the Imperial Valley? In 1918, the Coachella Valley Water District was formed once again to serve, and it was a county water district to serve the ag interest and some of the developing urban interest in Coachella Valley. By the 1920s, Southern Sierra Company had bought out the Coachella Valley Ice and Energy Company, and it was serving both the Imperial and the Coachella Valleys, but this cost problem still was there. And what happened then is that the IID then began to explore the possibilities of forming its own utility and providing power to ag and some rural residential users in the Imperial Valley, and began to compete with the entity that was providing energy in Imperial Valley. That resulted in finally, about 1920s, that IID began to assume these things. And when it was really exploring this issue in 1926, it was about this time that the federal government, wanting to control the yearly flows of the Colorado River and in connection with a lot of economic interests that were behind the development of the Colorado River in order to facilitate growth in the far west, developed the Boulder Canyon Project. Are we still there? Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Oswald.
I've lost my video. Well, if you can hear me, I'll just continue on. At that time, the Boulder Canyon Project in 1928, as conceived by the federal government, was going to serve both the Coachella Valley through a separate canal to Coachella Valley and a separate canal serving Imperial Valley. When it was finally written up, however, in 1932, the federal government chose to deal only with the Imperial Irrigation District. Oh, there, I think I'm back.
Okay.
And when it did that, it entered into a contract in 1932 with the Imperial Irrigation District to supply water and did not include Coachella Valley. Well, Coachella Valley Water District and the folks who lived in Southern Coachella Valley obviously objected to this. The IID filed what is called a validation action in 1932. That's the typical action filed by a public entity to resolve all challenges that may be made against an agreement or a passing of some legislation. As a consequence, CBWD objected to it. The matter went all the way to the California Supreme Court, but before the California Supreme Court could decide it, IID Coachella Valley, with the blessing of the federal government, entered into the 1934 Compromise Agreement. This 1934 Compromise Agreement, as you can see, had its genesis in the development of water rights in both the Coachella and the Imperial Valley. It wasn't just about that, though. The agreement, as in terms of its water rights, required the Coachella Valley to subordinate its claims on the river to that of the IID, but in return, the Coachella Valley or the Coachella Canal was going to be constructed and would deliver water to Coachella Valley straight from the Colorado River. All-American Canal would be constructed along the southern border of Imperial Valley, and that would be the canal serving the ag development in Imperial Valley. But in addition, as part of the agreement, there was a decision or an agreement made as to how the power possibilities of the power development of Coachella Valley would be resolved. And it was agreed at that time that Coachella Valley Water District would give up any right to power possibilities for a 100-year period in return for a lease by the IID of all the power possibilities that would be developed supposedly on the canal system and serving the Coachella Valley area. The parties signed the agreement. They proceeded onward. The IID finally acquired the electric companies that had been serving the area. And I think that was in 1943 when they fully began to serve the Coachella Valley with electricity. By this time, the canals were operating, and as it turned out, there were no hydroelectric developments made on the canals that served both Coachella and Imperial. The way the arrangement ran, though, is that the IID would pay the equivalent of what is called 8% net proceeds, which I'll talk about a little bit more later. And that money would be used at first to repay the federal government for the cost of constructing the Coachella Valley Canal on behalf of the Coachella Valley Water District. And from its other operations, power operations, the IID would repay the federal government for the cost of the construction of the All-American Canal. Both of those repayment obligations have been satisfied. And since that time, when the way the agreement was written, that 8% net proceeds would then be paid to Coachella Valley Water District. And I'm not exactly sure when that obligation on behalf of Coachella Valley was fully amortized, but things went along until, the 1980s or so, when Coachella Valley started to ask the IID and to account for its proceeds. And it turned out that there was never any lease executed between Coachella Valley and the Imperial Irrigation District. And even though the agreement had called for this 100-year lease, litigation was brought by Coachella Valley Water District over this, and the courts decided in a series of cases that, in fact, though there was no lease, that the agreement itself would serve as the template for an agreement and as it were a lease between the parties. And so that set the terms of the agreement. Now, interestingly enough, the court also held that with respect to these operations, the Coachella Valley and IID could be considered a joint venture. And that has implications possibly when they reach the end of this agreement in 2033. But as a result of that, the IID paid 8% of its net proceeds from all of its operations to CVWD. And CVWD to date has been paid something on the order of $43 million. And it is likely, when we project, that between now and the end of the agreement, more than $20 million will be paid, so that during the duration of this lease, approximately $65 million have been paid to Coachella Valley Water District. One of the interesting things that has happened, and it bears on what we're talking about here today, is that in the 80s and 90s, there were increasing fights among the states as to who was going to get what amount of water from the Colorado River. Originally, California, through a series of agreements and finally through litigation, California was given an entitlement of 4.4 million acre feet. But it continued to overdraw on that, as Arizona and Nevada, neither of which were fully developed, have need for it. But Arizona finally brought suit and challenged that and forced California to limit its take of water from the Colorado to 4.4 million acre feet per year. Now, an acre foot is 1 acre, the equivalent of water to cover 1 acre of ground 1 foot deep. I calculated it out, it's like 325,850 some gallons of water. It's commonly believed that that is the amount of water which a family of four uses for all of its domestic uses within 1 year. So for every acre foot of water that you hear people talk about, that's basically the standard measure used to satisfy the domestic needs of 1 four-person family. With these decisions that occurred, the parties, CVWD, the Metropolitan Water District, San Diego County Water Authority, and the State of California, and the IID entered into what is called the quantification settlement agreements. It goes by the rubric of QSA. They were executed finally in 2003. And what it did was it reduced the Imperial Irrigation District's overall entitlement to 3.1 million acre feet. Preserved and understood and sanctified that IID had a present perfected right to 2.6 million acre feet, which is derived from its historical appropriation of water all the way back to the 1890s, but it was recognized through a Supreme Court decision as of about, I think, 1914. That reduction of water to the IID, which I can tell you right now, was not something that the IID willingly agreed to. It was done as a result of pressure by the state of California and also by the federal government, but the IID nevertheless agreed to that. But as a part of that agreement, the IID agreed to transfer water through the QSA, and that became the largest ever transfer of ag water to urban areas in the history of the United States. But through that agreement, the IID has been transferring 200,000 acre feet of water to the San Diego County Water Authority, 105,000 acre feet of water to the Met, and now, and since then, about up to 100,000 acre feet of water to Coachella Valley Water District. All of those are done as a reduction of IID's historic apportionment of, or agreed upon apportionment of 3.1 million acre feet. So where are we today? It is no secret that for a number of years now, people and entities in the Coachella Valley have been concerned about their lack of a voice on the board of the IID and making decisions with respect to the power operations. But you've got to understand that, and trying to give you this historical context, what this means. The IID, the way it's evolved over the years as an irrigation district, it is empowered by statute to provide both water and power. And in fact, the statute specifically provides that the IID can provide water outside, provide energy outside of its water service territory. And the Southern Coachella Valley is outside the water service territory of the IID. That, those actions that may be taken by either the state or other entities that infringe upon that right of water are something that this IID board has basically said over the years, there's a line in the sand here that we can't cross, and we won't cross, and we won't permit it to be crossed. And that has been part of the problem, and that's why I wanted to give to you this historical context and let you see some of these strings that have come together historically that have gotten us to where we are today. Now, this current bill by Assemblyman Chad Mays, that's not the first iteration of concern expressed by the Coachella Valley about representation. And I'm sure our board members, and I've heard it from our board members, they understand there is that concern. But it's not a simple problem that can be dealt with a simple solution, because it involves these other issues. I'm not going to say that it's not soluble or insoluble. It is soluble. And I'm not saying that the interests of the Coachella Valley for its concerns over representation are somehow wrong or anything else. They're not. They're merely competing interests. But understanding what the party's vital interests are, I think, are essential. And I'd also think it explains some of the admitted reluctance on the part of the IID board in the past to deal with this issue. Because I'm sure that the board in the past has recognized that solving this particular issue in a way that's acceptable to Coachella Valley could or possibly infringe upon the ability of the boards to this board to make decisions about its water. And that is that, what I say is that line in the sand that our board just won't allow to be crossed. So what has happened historically over the last 30 years?
Well, Frank, can we summarize, please, so we can give John an opportunity, and I'm sure there's going to be questions and comments. Thank you.
I'm glad to telescope it. Today, Chad, Assemblyman Mays has got AB 1021, and that is a bill that has, I think, two components. One is to add, it was originally to add three ex officio members to our board, and now it's been changed by his amendment to add one. There's also a component that wants to involve the LAFCOs of Riverside County and Imperial County to study the issue and report back on by 2022, I believe, concerning how this issue can be resolved. That portion of the bill of AB 1021, in which a member is to be added to the board, I don't believe is going to be acceptable to the Imperial Irrigation District because, number one, even though they're non-voting members, they would attend closed sessions. They would be privy to information having to do with water. They would be privy to information having to do with the arguments that are ongoing about the allocation of the Colorado River and its rights. And to that extent, there's just this irreducible problem that you can't address by having somebody who's not an elected board member from Imperial County sit on our board and decide. The board, however, I think is at a position where it recognizes it can't ignore this problem any longer. And are there solutions? Well, there are a number of possibilities, and they've been looked at on a number of occasions. For example, in 1998, the IID proposed a joint powers authority, and for whatever reason, that never seemed to get off the ground and went away. In 2008, Assemblywoman Garcia had proposed to hold a referendum, and that was not successful because the IID agreed to expand the membership of the ECAC to include 10 members from Coachella Valley. The ECAC, this advisory committee, has acted since then to advise the IID on matters involving energy. Whether it's effective or not, or satisfy the needs of Coachella Valley, is something that you folks in Coachella Valley, of course, have to decide for yourself. But there are other possibilities. For example, you could refocus the ECAC so that it would have a more effective vote and give it some more plenary authority, appointment authority by the Coachella Valley representatives to appoint the members there. That may not be a solution that's viable as far as you're concerned. There could be possibilities of entering into memorandums of understanding or even JPAs. All of those are among the range of possible solutions. But one of the possibilities to consider is the role of the Coachella Valley Water District. Up to this point, the Coachella Valley Water District has been reluctant to be involved in the discussions involving this matter as it has evolved. And that is unfortunate because under the 34 agreement, the CBWD has a right to refuse to agree to any assignment of any assets of the power assets of the IID without its consent. It's a necessary party, we think, to these discussions about how this thing and the power operations and the ability to serve this Coachella Valley evolve. And it needs to be a party to it. It's been given $45 million. I understand in looking at their balance sheet, they have cash reserves in the neighborhood of $470 million with cash and investment equivalents. Now, I don't know of any situation in which CBWD has stepped up and offered to defray any costs of development in Coachella Valley. And so not offered to help pay for a substation. I don't know of any pole widening expense it's agreed to pay. But certainly that $45 million that the IID has paid to CBWD is money that has been generated from power operations and from ratepayers who live in Coachella Valley. So we think—
Frank, anything else? And we've got somebody on a double speaker out there.
I think that none of these solutions are necessarily something that have to be followed, but they're all possibilities, I think, that need to be considered. And I just wanted you folks to understand the complexity of the situation and all of the impacts that it could have, because it reaches far beyond just what goes on with the power supply or the power provision of electricity into the Southern Coachella Valley. So thank you.
Thank you very much. John Noble, representative for Assemblyman Mays.
Yeah, thank you for the introduction. And just to start, Chad just wants to pass along his apologies for not being here. He is on a flight back to the district from Sacramento, so it would have been tough to do a Zoom. I guess, a quick update in terms of what we're doing. I think everybody's pretty darn familiar with the bills my boss has introduced over the past 3 years. First, we started with adding 6 directors to IID's board from the electrical service area, since the ESA kind of has the majority of the population. We kind of went full steam ahead into that one, and IID brought up a lot of very good points about how that would kind of be a hostile takeover of their water rights, even though we're only looking at the electrical side of things. So that bill didn't really end up going anywhere. Last year, we introduced a study bill that was killed because of COVID. The legislature only really wanted to do COVID-related things. So this year, we tried to take a much more modest approach by appointing a non-voting member to IID's board of directors to make sure that there is a seat at the table for the Coachella Valley as this agreement winds down and everybody figures out what the next best steps are. You know, for us, I think when you're talking about an agreement that no one was really alive for, it's not necessarily unreasonable to look at some of the principles in that agreement under a modern lens. And for us, that's the idea of representation for an elected body. Frank made some good points about these folks having access to closed door meetings and attorney-client privilege. And to be completely honest, that's absolutely our intent, because we have public meetings and then we have private meetings for these boards of directors. And it's important that the Coachella Valley's interests are represented in those closed door meetings and that our folks have a seat at the table. And then, you know, that's kind of the first part in terms of solving what happens over the next 10 or 12 years. And the second is starting with that LAFCO study to make sure that both our local agency formation committee commissions that are in charge of these issues start to look at what the next best steps are in terms of government structure, ensuring electrical, ensuring there's electricity provided to the Coachella Valley, and then just, you know, voting rights for the folks who are impacted every day by the decisions IID's board makes. I think Chad has said a number of times that for us, this really isn't about water rights. IID has some of the better water rights in the state and arguably the nation. So there is absolutely a strong desire to protect that, because it is, you know, economically beneficial for the entire region that they keep those. And, you know, we're willing to look at changes to the language that might make everybody more comfortable to ensure those water rights are taken care of. But for us, the three things that are fundamental is representation for the Coachella Valley, ensuring good electrical service in perpetuity, and then protecting those water rights. You know, unfortunately for y'all, I'm not quite as eloquent as Frank, so I'm kind of just happy to take questions and talk through any questions we might have about this bill, what Chad's intent is, and that sort of thing.
Great. Thank you very much, John, for your brevity. Did you have a question, Russell Betts?
Yeah, I was going to suggest that possibly we either continue this item to another meeting. We've taken up a lot of time here. It's a certainly an important, interesting subject, but I think we've lost all time we have for other subject items.
Right. We'll be going a little bit long. And I will say that I have somewhat requested from Tom that we reconvene the key players again that we pulled together. It's been over a summer, about a year and a half ago. And this committee will be invited to that, as well as the key parties, CVWD and IID, and the assembly members, both Garcia and Mays, to try to keep the discussion moving forward. You know, I do appreciate that Assembly Mays is looking out for members in his district. And it's been said multiple times by several jurisdictions that are impacted in terms of the Riverside County, that this really is about energy and it's not about water. And I appreciate Frank going through the history of the complexity of it, but it's been made very clear by all of us that it's always about energy and not about water, and that solutions are not coming from his board, they're coming from their attorney, and that to negate some of the things that are being proposed by us, but suggesting others, I take somewhat offense to, but I do appreciate the background for those that may not have known about it. And representation is critical, and to keep going back on water rights, that's not our issue. It's clearly, we have a water provider and they do just fine. And obviously the contractual arrangement between CVWD and IID was separate and apart from any expectation on their part that they should be doing a portion of what we expect representation that we have from IID, but I agree with you, Russell, that we probably need to continue this one since we have two other action items to discuss quite lengthy. And hopefully that this will spark that re-interest that I was hoping to ensure that we keep moving it forward, because time is running out and we need to get some solutions that both sides will be amenable to at least entertain versus keeping it one-sided is what my perception is. But again, I'm open for solutions since my residents are severely impacted come 2033. Supervisor Perez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for purposes of time, I'm going to hold off on my questions and thoughts. Let me just say thank you, though, to Frank and John for that, for your information, and specifically for that history lesson. That's pretty fascinating. Mm-hmm. Very interesting how we got here. With that said, I'm just going to hold off till next time because I think there's a lot to discuss, and I appreciate the presentations. Yeah.
Thank you. Agreed. Okay, you both are welcome to stay on for the next couple items. We are talking a little bit about goals and objectives, but first we're going to do the appointment of our regional representative to SCAG Policy Committee. And I know Peter's going to be reviewing this, and Oscar's been a representative, and I know he wants to do it again. So Peter, shorter is better.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll refrain from summarizing the staff report and just note that we are recommending that this committee discuss appointing or reappointing a representative to SCAG's Energy and Environment Committee and present that appointment, or I guess supposed nomination, to the Executive Committee for their June meeting. With that, I'll hand it back over to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And Oscar, do you want to say anything regarding your role and your desire to continue, besides you've enjoyed it and you want to continue?
Besides that, no, I think I really do enjoy it. I love reporting back to our community. Can you hear me there?
Yes, it's a little broken, okay. But we can
hear
you.
Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity. Okay. Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to be there, and I enjoy it. And you know, I obviously respect the will of the committee as well. So if there's anyone else that you would like to send out there, I definitely respect that, but I'll be happy to do it again.
Thank you. We've got a raised hand from Russell Betts.
Madam Chair, I'd like to, if you're accepting, nominations or a motion to approve Councilmember Ortiz is to continue serving on SCAG. He's done a most excellent job in that role, and I think we are very well served to have him in that position.
I second the motion, Madam Chair.
Okay, we've got a motion from Russell Betts, Desert Hot Springs, and a second from Supervisor Perez, District 4. Any other questions or comments? All those in favor, please say aye. Wiggle some fingers.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Anybody abstain? Seeing none, motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much, Oscar, for your service and your continued service, and we look forward to future updates.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
We got to work on broadband in India.
I'm in Desert Hot Springs.
Oh, okay. Well, then.
My connection's clear.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to 6D, which is the goals and objectives for fiscal year 2021-2022. Oscar, you still have sound on and it's quite muddled. Chairman Gruby, I thank you for your... Okay, we're going to move on to goals and objectives. And just a quick recap, you've got your staff report there. Just a notation on the staff report that the italicized items are follow-up items from our discussions. And clearly we talked about the waste reduction goals, how Fine Food Bank and Protect are going to be tackling the Senate Bill 1383. We talked a little bit about the salt and sea component, ozone layers. So I'm going to open it up because, well, first of all, I know we've got to, if we want to do, Katie, go ahead and do your staff report if you want to give an overview. We do have a request to speak from Chuck Parker, and then we'll take some questions and consensus from the floor if we can.
Madam Chair, I'll be brief, given the time. As you noted, the italicized items are changes based on the discussion of the last meeting, which was lively and helpful and informative. I think I don't have any comments unless there are specific items that the members would like to modify, and we do have a public comment, so if we want to just go to that, we can then take input from the committee. Thank you.
Okay, let's go ahead, if you don't mind, committee, to do the public comment. It's Chuck Parker, and he also submitted a written comment. I don't know if all of you received it, some of us may have, but let's call upon Chuck to give his public comment, and then we'll get down into any questions or potential changes that you might have based on the report that's been presented. So if Trish can.
Hi, Chair Evans. Was expecting Chuck to come in to make his comment. But it looks like he's not there. I will pull up
his proposed red line changes.
Yes.
Great.
So regarding support of the concept of water importation, he wants it to read, and the independent, there we go. So these are the changes that Chuck Parker is proposing. He just wanted some changes on the wording of items. So these are slides he submitted for your consideration.
And Madam Chair, if I might just point out to the committee, this is with regard to salt and sea restoration. And so the changes are those regarding items 2, 3, and 4, as you see here, with the underlines showing the changes that Mr. Parker had proposed.
And I know we had a lot of discussion last meeting regarding the study that was being conducted by Santa Cruz versus the inclusion of the importation of ocean water, since 9 cities had endorsed that through resolution. And while Chuck had proposed some of that combination wording, I would like to suggest possibly adding a number 6 to that salt and sea category, and specifically saying supporting the concept of ocean water from the Sea of Cortez as part of the restoration as endorsed by the 9 cities. So it recognizes what many of the jurisdictions that sit on this committee have already requested or agreed to support, and then including that as a separate option of potential action versus the merged version that he was proposing is kind of education related versus specific task oriented. That number 4, that combination that he proposed was providing information versus actual use of imported water. So I don't know, I would kick around separating those and just adding that as a number 6 so that we do recognize and include that, since there was clearly some support last time. But let's go to raised hands. I don't know who raised their hand first, but I'm gonna call upon Russ Betts. He's been short.
I just got a text from Chuck Parker. He says he's on, but nobody can hear him talking. And so we have a technical issue with the public comment. I don't know what else to say regarding that at this point, but I'm sure he would like to speak on this issue.
All right. Well, let's see if we can work with staff if we can get Supervisor Perez. Go ahead and make the comments, Russ.
Yeah, and I'll be brief because I think you summarized it. I think, you know, we have 9 cities who have signed on to a C2C solution, and I think that needs to be reflected in this, in the goals. I think if we had included that in the goals in the last meeting, we probably wouldn't even be having this discussion today. We would all be happy that everybody's favorite plan was equally represented in the document. I think what's been submitted and was provided to us was provide information to the member jurisdictions and support efforts to restore and revitalize the Salton Sea, including the North Lake concept being developed by the Salton Sea Authority and the importation of ocean water from the Sea of Cortez as endorsed by all 9 cities of the Coachella Valley would be item 4. If we could make that revision, I think that would satisfy me and a lot of people who favor that. The other one would be is we have a study by the Santa Cruz, University of Santa Cruz, on feasibility of the C2C import. And I think it would be good to have them also, encourage them also to look at all the options, including the Perimeter Lake, the North Lake, as far as feasibility goes, and taking a look at the feasibility of covering the entire rest of the sea with gravel or whatever the plan is to control to mitigate the dust and the environmental hazards that are coming off of there. I don't understand why they would only be limited to a feasibility study at one option, when from my view, the most feasible plan, since we do it, we've been doing it for thousands of years, the conveyance of water from one location to another is probably the most feasible, and the most unique and least studied are some of these other options that have come up for trying to deal with this. And so I just think if we would make this completely balanced then everything would be great. Or in the alternative, just scrap all the goals and just say, we support restoration of the sea and leave it at that. So that would be my short comments. And depending on discussion, I may have more. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's go, Supervisor Perez.
Well, are we, does this need to be adopted today? I mean, are we prepared to make sausage right now?
Yeah, the goal was is last month we had much discussion on it. We provided recommendations to Katie for revised to be presented to us today. And we would like to make the adoption. We could do it at our June meeting if need be, but I'd really like to shore up, pun intended, to get as close to agreement from all of us so that all of our components are included and something that this committee can support and move forward with.
All right. That being the case, we'll be here for a bit. And I don't mind, I actually appreciate what's written already here, the 1 through 5. However, your point is well taken, Madam Chair, regarding the, and I don't have the language in front of me. You put it up earlier.
Can we put up proposed number six?
Mm-hmm. I do think that that should be separate. I agree. Yeah. But I also think that agreeing with Russell Betts now as well, that we should look at all the options. Not only the Sea of Cortez option, but there are other ideas that have come to us that came to me as well related to the Pacific Ocean. Now, I don't know how feasible that is, to be honest with you, but at the end of the day, I do think though it should have all the options. Now, as far as the other language that I saw earlier, I think it was maybe from Chuck, mm-hmm. related to number two, the feasibility of various restoration options, including the North Lake and Perimeter Lake, that's already included in the Salton Sea Management Plan. That's already part of the 10-year plan. Both the North Lake project, pilot project, as well as the Perimeter Lake concept. So for us to go backwards now, if you will, to do a feasibility study, that already had taken place when AB 71 actually had passed back in the day. When they actually did conduct that study. So I don't think we need to put that back in. But other than that, I appreciate what's already written here, 1 through 5, your idea of separating it out to a number 6, and then as well, just adding that we should look at all the options and then deleting, I would say, the idea of a feasibility of the North Lake pilot project as well as the Perimeter Lake.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Dennis.
We're gonna get you, Madam Mayor. This was before my time, so I had a chance to pull up our resolutions. And mm-hmm. we support options, including the C to C, but we didn't say the C to C was the option that we should pursue. And I just want to be clear on that from my reading of our resolutions that supported this. So all options obviously are on the table. I think we should continue to look at all options, including C2C.
Agreed. Absolutely agree. Oscar?
Can you hear me okay there?
Yes.
Okay. I agree with keeping all the options in our suggestions for the Salton Sea. And I also agree on Mr. Parker's addition in number 3 of including environmental impacts as well as potential revenues or potential funding. Another note that I wanted to add is I would like to include hydrogen fuels in section number 4. Sorry, let me pull it up. In section number 5 of sustainable resource use, mm-hmm. when we say identify, it's item number 2.
Yes.
Identify and encourage. I would also like to include hydrogen fuels there.
So identify and
encourage. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. So number 2 would be potentially revised to identify and encourage opportunities for access to biogas, biofuels, and hydrogen.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Back to Russell.
Yes.
Unmute. Here we
Thank
go.
You.
So in response to Supervisor Perez's comments, if we're going to exclude including the North Lake and the Perimeter Lake from the UC Santa Cruz study, my suggestion would be we just make no reference to the Santa Cruz study. That is viewed, those who favor the C2C solution view this UC Santa Cruz study not as a step forward in that plan, but as a further delay, another 1 to 2 years of study in something that's already been studied to death. And so from my perspective, that's just delaying it. I think the solution to that would be that this body just say, you know what, we're going to be silent on the UC Santa Cruz study, and that we're going to, and by being silent, we're at least respecting the wishes of the 9 cities who've all signed on, as Councilmember Woods has expressed, to the C2C solution. And I, the whole point here is that I don't want to give short shrift to anything right now. That's the fair thing to do. And as these are presented, were originally presented, or even in the agenda, don't take into proper account the sentiments of the many of the cities that are represented by this organization. And I think that's what E&E needs to do. And on the you know, the 10-year plan, I don't think there's been any discussion here, extensive discussion here on that 10-year plan. That's the Salt and Sea Authority, apparently in favor of that. But I don't think E&E is weighed in on that one or offered that as its official goal. I understand that the sentiments run pretty strongly on this, but I'm just trying to get to the point where anybody who favors the C2C solution isn't being given, isn't having their position discounted or diminished in any way. So my proposal would be, if somebody's going to make a motion, would be to just remove any reference to the UC Santa Cruz study, for starters, and then go with what item 6 as a 6th item, as the chairwoman has pointed out, and go with that. I'll hold my comments beyond that.
Yeah, I could actually support that, Russ. I think that makes sense. I don't have an issue with that. The only reason why I bring up the issue of studying the North Lake once again, pilot project, or even the Perimeter Lake, it's been studied. Right, and we're talking about another study to study the study, then I don't think it's necessary, like you're mentioning, right?
Why? I think it was free. That was the point, right? It was free.
So, and quite frankly, we just received the $20 million for the North Lake project to begin that process, right? It is part of the Salt Sea Management Plan, 10-year plan. It's like the Perimeter Lake, that is. It's a midterm, if you will, type of solution. But I don't have an issue with going ahead and just taking out the study altogether out of number 2 or 3 or whichever one that was.
It was 2.
And adding number 6. I think that makes sense.
I would support that as well. And just looking at the overall changes that we made, we effectively put in the need for clean water, especially quality of life benefits for East Valley and all over the Valley. We included conservation water quality with CVWD in general, aside from Salton Sea. We included exploration of the compromise agreement and how we're going to solve that soon to be expiration and need to continue power. We included energy storage, battery storage, pumped energy storage, microgrids. We made some very positive changes on air monitoring and ozone with AQMD. I'm looking for the other pieces. That's solid waste. We talked about this SB 1383. So I think that, you know, the biggest, I think, discussion was the Salt and Sea piece. And the reality is recognizing the 9 city component, not as the only solution, but clearly as one of the options to consider, since we all agree that that would be an option to explore and consider as well. I see a raised hand from Donna in Indian Wells.
Madam Chair, if I might, Mr. Parker has also now joined the meeting, and after Council Member Griffith, you could
Perfect.
Be available.
That is what I wanted to say, is that I really wanted to hear from Chuck Parker, and I see he's on the attendee side with his hand up.
Perfect. All right, let's bring him up then. Chuck, we can unmute you and go. Thanks for joining.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. It's all yours.
Okay, thank you. Well, I don't need to say too much because I believe, you know, what you all have worked out, it would be, would satisfy my concerns. Adding the number six to include ocean water import, that was my primary concern. And if we drop the, you know, the study, then I think it would be a fair balanced thing. It would, represent the whole community's views. Mm-hmm. I am a little concerned that but it may not have to be stated now, that the CVAG Environment Committee keep an eye on the proposed ways of extracting lithium to make sure that those are not, super polluting, because a lot of methods used to do that do create a lot of pollution. But I think that the compromise that you guys have come to satisfies my concerns, and I appreciate the discussion. It's been good. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you, Chuck. And I will add to follow up on what Oscar had indicated. One of the other proposed revisions that Chuck made on number three was to include environmental impacts. And I like that addition as well. So if we all support the potential of removing number two, knowing that many of those items and that piece is encompassed in other things that have already occurred, the proposed item six will clearly obviously become number five. It'll just move up that way. Is there any contention over that consideration? Russ, I see a hand up again.
Could I put you on the spot to forward the motion for the committee? I think you have a good handle on it.
Oh, well, if I'm allowed and you'll indulge me, sure. I would like to propose that we adopt the goals and objectives for Energy and Environmental Resources Committee for fiscal year 2021-2022 with the revisions under items number three, salt and sea restoration, removing number two in reference of the UC Santa Cruz study, including in item number three, provide committee members updates.
Particularly
environmental impacts. Yes, include environmental impacts. And then add the number, what will be now number five, I guess, if we eliminate two, the proposed wording to acknowledge the support of nine cities in the ocean importation.
I'd be happy to second that.
Okay, so motion from La Quinta, second from Desert Hot Springs. Any other questions or comments?
Madam Chair, can I just make a quick inquiry? I just wanted to see what Mr. Tom was thinking, Mr. Tom Kirk. Just, I know we've been kind of dominating the discussion. I wanted to hear a little bit from Tom about what his thoughts were. Could we give them that opportunity, Madam Chair?
I guess I can give him some time, and I think he can do that too. So, Tom, let's unmute. Let's hear from you. There you go.
I'm having technical difficulty and you can't hear me, I hope.
Nope. Sorry, you're on.
Oh, for God's sakes. C2C, talk about being studied. It's been studied for 50 years. And for those that want to save the Salton Sea with C2C, be careful what you wish for. Bringing seawater in will make the Salton Sea a dead sea. And if that's what we want as a region, we could do it. That's my two cents.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. So yes, it's supporting the concept of importation as a potential restoration option, in addition to all the other things we're exploring. So it doesn't rule that component out, but appreciate that. Russ, anything else? And Katie, I've got a call on Katie.
I'm just going to respond that in case anybody hasn't noticed and hasn't seen the news report on Channel 3, it's already a dead sea. And we're not talking about saving the sea. We're talking about restoring it. It's past the point of no return. And we've got to fix that. So I disagree with Tom's comments as well. Thank you.
Okay. Katie.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to verify that the changes in the motion also included number five, sustainable resources, the addition of hydrogen fuels, as mentioned by Councilmember Ortiz.
Yes, I would like to include the addition of hydrogen fuels as part of my motion. Great. Russ?
I thought that was in there.
Okay, I apologize if I didn't do that one. Yes. Any other changes, comments, additions? We will see this again we'll see this again as just a final document.
Yes, it will be reflected in the budget
Correct. Yes. Yes. All right. We have a motion and second on the floor. All those in favor, please say aye.
Wiggle your finger. Aye.
Aye. Oh, Tricia.
All right. We have an attendee with their hand up for a comment. Art Gertz, would you like to take this comment?
Yes. So yes, let's take it before we conclude.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes, Art, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Good. Just a few words from Vice Mayor of West Shores, otherwise known as the Third World. What the sea does not get credit for is it currently produces over 1 million acre feet of potable water per year, which most find a little bit astonishing, but it's a fact of nature that as the sea declines, the water that it, I see Mr. Perez is about to roll on the floor, but at any rate, don't look for my aluminum foil hat just yet. That water evaporates up into the atmosphere. And because that area is in a pressure bubble, you'll see the rain clouds up there and they slowly drift away. And so the point is, the more water, so if someone says we're gonna kill the sea irreparably by bringing water from the Sea of Cortez, well, the sea needs about 30 to 40% more volume to bring it up to optimum level. And by refilling Laguna Salada, which is about one third the size of Salton Sea, and refilling the sea to its optimum levels, you will, ask a meteorologist, you will increase rainfall in the area from Laguna Salada all the way up through the Salton Sea area. And rainfall is a good thing. And this is especially beneficial because it's east of the mountain range. We had the reason we get 1.5 inches of rainfall per year is we don't get rainwater coming in from the ocean. And so that's about all I have, other than would anyone like to comment on the build out finally of Travertine Point?
that's a whole nother meeting.
Okay, I thank you for your time.
No, I thank you too. So we can be rainmakers as well. I love that. So maybe it is about water and energy. I'm sorry, couldn't refuse. All right, any other comments, Tricia?
Madam Chair, this is Alex Carter, so I'm gonna choose to abstain from this vote, ma'am.
Okay, so we have a motion, a second. I ask for all those in favor, please say aye and wiggle their fingers.
Aye.
Any opposition? And then abstentions from IID. All right, that motion still passes and we have adopted goals and objectives for the next fiscal year. Strong work, team, strong work. Compromise for the day.
We made it work, thank you.
Yes, we did, thank you. I assume there's no other public comment on non-agenda items. I'll say there are some informational items there and then the announcements. We've got our next meeting on June 10th. Likely virtually as well. We'll see what happens because 15th is supposed to be our opening date. So I imagine we'll be doing it via Zoom. And then of course, executive committee is just before that for those that sit on executive. And thank you again for your extra time. You know, Tom reminded that we're not meeting every single month on this stuff. And so a few times a year, we get into a good discussion and we do have some more hefty items and appreciate that you've been able to take the extra time. And without ado, I will consider this meeting adjourned and thank you again. All right.